Well, welcome everybody to this final session. We're going to be doing a bit of crystal ball gazing and looking at what could be. If we put all of the best things together in sustainability, what would the ultimate bottle of wine look like? I'll just briefly introduce the guests. Tamlin.
Hi, I'm Tamlin Curran. I am a senior editor and sustainability editor for JanusRobinson.com. And I've worked for her for about 14, 15 years now.
David, over to you.
Hello, David Harvey from Rayburn Fine Wines. We're sort of specialist importers of small family artisan sized wineries with emphasis on organics and biodynamics for sort of total quality production. That means that a lot of them don't collect any data. On the other side, a lot of them do have really interesting case studies of what one can be doing in viticulture and packaging. But I've come to a realization that almost nobody is maximizing everything that they could do.
And Dom, over to you.
Hi, everyone. My name's Dom DeVille. I'm Director of Sustainability and Social Impact at the Wine Society. For those of you who don't know us, we're basically an online wine retailer, but we're owned by our members and we just sell in the UK.
Thanks, Dom. And my name is James Streeter. I am the chair of the leadership committee of the Sustainable Wine Roundtable. There's potentially loads to talk about here. Tamlin, can I ask you to maybe look at the actual winery growing part of it? Tell us a little bit about what would you envisage to be the way forward, the ultimate sustainable wine?
The question that we're discussing is carbon positive wine. So that would involve focusing on carbon footprint primarily, but it's amazing how much of everything else is tied in. If you're looking at your biodiversity, you're creating carbon reservoirs on your property. If you're planting trees, if you're planting cover crops, if you are doing sustainable viticulture and you're not tilling your soil, you're allowing your soil to hold more carbon. So yes, a wine producer trying to be carbon positive is going to end up being more positive in other areas of sustainability as well, like biodiversity, social justice, etc. I think what you're going to start with is your vineyard. You're going to start along the regenerative viticultural lines, using less chemicals, using less fossil fuels, tractor use in the vineyard, preserving your soils, planting trees, more green cover, all that kind of thing. Even things like keeping your old vines, because their root mass is as big, if not bigger, than the plant mass that we're seeing above ground, and their root mass is holding carbon. So all of that can go into your carbon accounting, as it were. One massive thing, California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance, they looked at their wineries and they did a great audit of them. And as we all know, packaging has a massive proportion of the footprint, and then transport has another one. So they said packaging, particularly glass bottles, 29%. That's not including the transport of the packaging. But if you just look at vineyard field emissions, and that is tractor use and fertilizer use and other chemical use, and your winery operations, you could, and you started operating on solar power with solar powered vehicles, you could actually reduce your carbon footprint by 31% in one go by putting solar power on your winery and running all your vehicles off solar power. And that's a massive change. And small wineries could do that as effectively as large wineries. That impacts your vineyard use. And it could also impact your personal use as a winemaker, your workers coming to and from work, driving between vineyards. I know that everyone is very focused on packaging. Obviously, we need to reduce glass, look at alternative forms of packaging. But I also believe that just starting with solar panels on every winery roof might make a very quick difference.
You're right. The title of this session was about carbon. I'd convinced myself during the day that it had to be more than that.
I think that they are all so interrelated, and we need to be very careful not to be reductionist in our thinking when it comes to sustainability. Carbon is related to biodiversity, related to waste and water management, related to social justice. All of these things are intricately connected. We can't compartmentalize all of them. If we're going to look at the solutions, they're all going to bring each other up, as it were.
Exactly. And one of the bits that work that Peter's leading is our global reference standard. And of course, that has to pick up on so many different elements of sustainability. Yeah. And then how do you translate those into something which is easily understandable by the next part in the value chain and ultimately by the consumer? Dom, let me turn to you. You're a very significant retailer in the UK. I buy a lot of my wine from you, so keep doing it. You obviously distribute all around the country. Perhaps you could just sort of outline a few thoughts on what that low carbon, carbon positive, sustainable part of the wine value chain looks like and feels like to you.
To give us kind of a sense of scale of what we're talking about from shipping and distribution, it would typically be about 20, 21% of a retailer like ours total emissions. So that's your inbound logistics. So that's taking the wine from winery into England or whichever country you're in. And that would be about 15%. And then the onward distribution, so from your warehouses to your customers' homes, about 6%. Obviously, that's going to vary from country to country. So about 20%. So it's quite a significant bit. The problem with shipping and distribution, you're sort of limited in a way in what you can do. If I think about the next 5-10 years, in that shorter term, think three main things. I could see a bit of a shift from road to rail. In terms of the transport used, roads got a much higher carbon emissions than other forms of transport. Again, it's a general average. These figures come from Kuehne+Nagel, a shipping company, but the carbon intensity of shipping by deep sea, so like one of these big container ships, is about 7 grams of carbon equivalent per ton per kilometre. So that's 7 grams. So that's for deep sea. You compare that with rail, which is about 24 grams, three times higher. Road goes up to about 137 grams, and then air goes up to about 654 grams. It's not necessarily the distance traveled, it's the mode of transport used. While we may not have much choice but to use ships right now, there are some instances where we can move our routes from road to rail, such as hubs near wineries to the port, for example. I can see that rail freight expanding. Second area, moving to electric vans for last mile delivery. It's a no-brainer. It's an obvious one. You know, a lot still being done by diesel, especially in the UK. And then thirdly, optimizing how the wine is transported. So for us as a retailer that ships stuff in, it's what Tamlin was just talking about there, using more alternative packaging, bag in box, plastic PET bottles. You can fit much more of those on a pallet than glass bottles. Therefore, you can get much more in a container. Exploring bulk shipping. And I deliberately say exploring because it's not going to work for every line. It depends how, what your volumes are, where it's coming from, how it's coming in, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't work for every line, for everyone. It can reduce your carbon emissions. Another area for optimization, which we're looking at, is consolidation. So making sure that when a container is brought across the world with wine, it's as full as it can be. The industry is pretty good at it, but there are some wine regions where you might buy less volume from. And so then it's really hard to kind of get that consolidation. So there's still a lot more work, I think, to be done around that, whether that's ordering less often but larger quantities, or getting a bunch of wineries to all send their wine to the same hub if it's going to the same country, and then only shipping when the container's full, buddying up with other retailers. So there are ways of looking at it. So that's short-term stuff. Then the medium to long-term, it's really about decarbonisation of transport. The ships, trains, trucks, planes, moving into greener fuels like biofuels, electrification, sustainable aviation fuels. If anybody does use planes, we don't, but some might. That's sort of 10, 15, 20 years away. And then I think the other thing you'll start to see a lot more of, particularly from the retailer side, is them being a lot more selective over which shippers and distributors they work with. Carbon reduction is going to get elevated to a similar level of importance and procurement criteria to things like cost and service. We might not be there yet because shipping costs have gone up by about 50% in the last year. But as things settle over the next few years, I think you'll start to see many more retailers moving in that direction, and only working with shippers and distributors that have basically got aggressive carbon reduction plans in place themselves.
I think what this opens up to me, Dom, is this vast difference between what's within your control and what's outside of it. You know, you've mentioned two of the very difficult to handle issues of decarbonizing ships and, to a certain extent, airplanes as well. How did you balance that? You want to put a plan in place, right? You commit to your customers, to your consumers. We're going to go to this low carbon agenda. How do you balance that challenge of, right, well, this is what we can do inside our warehouse and immediately, and those very difficult things to deal with are outside of your control?
So with our carbon reduction plan, there are different levels. So there are things under our direct control that we've got 100% influence over. So an example of that would be our own delivery vans. We have a fleet of 35 delivery vans. It's in our gift entirely to change those to electric when the technology is there. It's not quite there yet because wine is very heavy to transport and the mileage that they need to do is not quite there. But when it is, we can do that. That's one area. Then it's where you've got high influence, but less, you know, you don't have direct control over it. So that might be how the wine is brought into the country, bulk shipping, alternative packaging. So that's about working with your producers around that. Then you've got another area where you've got low influence and low control. That might be the choosing the shippers that you work with and coming together into industry groups, retailers coming together to push the whole sector, the shipping distribution sector, to move quicker. So it's having a stronger voice and a bit more leverage. And then you've got the last one, which it's a bit of a waiting game, really. You've got to wait for stuff to decarbonize. You know, again, you can add your voice into industry groups and things. It's about waiting. You put your plans into those buckets and do what you can.
That's really well explained. Thank you for that. David, you've been working on a number of things around sustainability in the wine value chain. Tell us a few of your ideas and for the vision of the future.
Three or four things that occur to me that stand out. One thing to start with would be that until the last millennia, we've been farming Vitis vinifera everywhere. Humid zones, this calls for spraying either organically or so-called conventionally, except for regions which are dry, you know, not humid, where you have no disease pressure. And heritage regions, let's say Montalcino or Burgundy, where you can inset or offset the cost of spraying and the impact of spraying. Pretty much the rest of the wine world could now be moving on to replanting or head grafting onto the so-called new vinifera. In one of the talks earlier, we had someone from British Columbia who referred to things as hybrids. The French government ruling is now that once you're sort of 93-95% DNA from Vitis vinifera in a hybrid crossing, the French government said they're just now called vinifera because they're indistinguishable. So these so-called fifth generation new vinifera, which the Germans call peewees and the French call residue, but peewees never going to catch on in North America, so we should just drop that. These new vinifera, you know, they need one or two background sprays a year to keep latent trunk disease and so on at bay. So let's say Sauvignon de Touraine, why are we growing Sauvignon Blanc and spraying it 15 times with the copper and sulfur? Soil compaction, killing soil life, terrible for carbon retention and for biodiversity. Why are we still growing Sauvignon Blanc in Touraine when we should be growing the three new Italian Sauvignons called Sauvignon Kratos, Sauvignon Nepis, Sauvignon Rytos? You can't plant them unless you declare them as being experimental vineyards that you're prepared to rip out. But the EU ruling is that anybody in Europe can plant them as long as another member state has approved them. They're approved in Italy, the French can plant them. You can't call them Sauvignon de Touraine, but you could call them brand Sauvignons, plural, and grow them and sell them for the same money, take higher yields, not have to spray, allow your soil to build up, work on your composting, and that's going to have the biggest carbon insetting impact you can possibly have. So getting rid of classic vinifera, for me, is the biggest thing that I can see in the future. And that means pretty much everywhere in the wine world. Okay, Barossa Valley, not much disease, or 1 year in 5 or 10, fine, grow your ungrafted vinifera. But there's many regions where we should be moving forwards now. As a company, for our repackaging, we got rid of mixed materials and plastic tape and all the rest of it and went for recyclable, compostable, reusable cardboard packaging. So I put a proposal forward for the UK's largest bonded warehouse to move all of their repack materials and look at promoting reusing things 50 or 100 times. You know, they're strong enough. You can send wine out in them, flatten them, have them collected by the driver, put them back together again, use them again, and they can go 50 or 100 times very happily. So they cost a lot more, but they just go round and round and round forever. Whereas right now, pretty much all boxes that go to UK restaurants are cardboard with plastic tape on with 1,000-year half-life for not decomposing. And because they're mixed materials, they just go into landfill. that's a big thing to move on in the UK trade. The third thing is that we talked about alternative formats earlier. Many of the world's wine regions, you know, most amazing wine regions, are on the edge of the world's largest cities, nowhere more so than China. As well as putting wine in cans and lighter bottles and plastic bottles, if you're in Martinborough, you could be sending bulk containers to Wellington to refill in the marketplace, or just using stainless steel clean canteen type things, sending them back to the winery. I've got a list here of 36 of the world's largest cities next to vineyards. So I'm not sure that's the solution for fine wine, ageable wine, but for house wine, everyday wine, refillable wine, I don't even think we need to be looking at single-use vessels of any format whatsoever, because clean canteens can go around thousands of times, if not more. You know, if a van's going on a drop, it's also going back to base, so you can be taking back empties. I know Scotland's driving its new deposit scheme. I don't know how that's going to work and what it's going to mean. And the UK is looking at it. And also, the UK doesn't have a big vineyard region next to a big UK city. So we're not going to be the first country in the world to trial this, but from Australia to Chile to China to France to Germany to Italy, South Africa, Cape Town is surrounded by some amazing vineyard regions. Why is anybody using house wine or everyday wine in a glass bottle? I have no idea. And the last thing, perhaps as a recap, Johan Reinecke this afternoon said we need to think about farming soil, not farming crop. And the second you get that in your mind, farming starts to make sense. The great Japanese farming philosopher Masanobu Fukuoka, one of his sort of great epithets was the old farming is growing of crops, but the cultivation and perfection of human beings. But that in a way is looking at our role interfacing with the land and what that does to us. But if we turn it around and put that down the food chain, the ultimate role of farming could be the custodianship of Mother Nature, of the land, even the smallest little bits that make up the majority of life on the planet, fungi, bacteria, nematodes, arthropods, with crops and human beings being the side product. Stop looking at grapes and we start looking at soil in vineyards. We'll build it up and look after it. And that means polyculture, and that means biodiversity, and that means more biomass. And that means Justin spoke earlier about, you know, we can only keep 10% of organic matter in soil. What if you deepen your soil over time? There's a lot of scope for looking after these things. But I have to admit, in all these things, I'm not a data gatherer. I'm more into the story and the concept and seeing these things happen. It's larger businesses who master the data, the analysis, the key indicators.
But it's the stories and the passion that make us all go out and do it and get people interested in doing it, David. So I've really enjoyed listening to your thoughts there, and particularly some of the things that you've picked up during the day. It's tremendous. I've got a couple of things which I was going to sort of add to this. I was originally going to be on the panel here. So a couple of thoughts then, really, just about what I would like to see. Imagine that ideal world. So all of this best practice that we've talked about is applied right across the value chain. Companies have sustainability integrated into their business. You know, that's being pushed through the finance sector at the moment. Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. They get sustainability into your strategy, into your governance, into the risk and opportunity management, into targets. That sustainable performance is then communicated right through the value chain. And imagine a bottle of wine. Each bottle has got its own sustainability value, which is easy to understand. Consumer can pick it up and say, yeah, this product is high, medium, low, or red, amber, green, or whatever the scale might be. And then procurement departments and consumers are informed and making decisions, purchasing decisions based on that knowledge and that information. And then picking up on one of your points, David, which was really about, you know, the regulation really and policy and how that sort of drives good and bad practice, where national, international policy, regulations and financial instruments, things like tax, support sustainable wine, which is my wonderful fantasy world. All sounds easy, eh? We can't do this alone. No single actor in the whole value chain or value web, really, because it's much more complicated than a chain, can do all of this. And, you know, through my experience, through my career, I've seen the whole agenda move from this individual mitigate regulatory approach right through to the value chain approach, the whole of chain approach. This has been really the driver for us setting up the Sustainable Wine Roundtable, has been to try and listen to that dialogue, listen to our members and try and move these things forward. So, for example, there won't be an international regulation for all of the wine value chain. There are certain organizations that will drive global agendas. So what we're trying to do is to create a global reference standard, which hopefully brings things together, create tools and to benchmark and to measure We want to research areas where there is little or no data to add to their decision making, to get us into that position of being able to make good decisions, and then collect and share that data. So that's really just to bring it all together as we close the conference now, is that the Sustainable Wine Roundtable is really here to try and pull all of this together. And we are incredibly grateful for all of our members, many of which you participated today. So I'd just like to say a huge thank you to all of our panelists and presenters today, and also the team, the Sustainable Wine Roundtable team that have really pulled together this conference, have worked really hard. So thank you, everybody.